This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zielinski.
G'day and welcome to Diplomates. I'm your host, Misha Zielinski. This week's episode is with Richard Marles, the Member of Parliament for the federal seat of Corio. Richard is the Deputy Leader of the Opposition and Labor's Shadow Minister for Defence. I caught up with Richard for a chinwag about how COVID-19 has accelerated history's timeline, the rising tensions in the Indo-Pacific, why the US is still a force for good, how Australia's record defence procurement program can rebuild our manufacturing sector, the choices facing Australia as it seeks to carve out an independent foreign policy, why sovereign capability is the new black, and how Australia must do much more with its key Pacific partners. And if I could just throw in a quick plug here, for the month of July, it just came to our attention at the show that we were the sixth most popular show in our category of politics in Australia. So big thank you to everyone who's been supporting the show. Big thanks to everyone who's been rating, reviewing and spreading the word. It's been really, really quite surprising how many political nerds there really are out there. But look, thanks so much. And without further ado, please enjoy the episode. Richard Marles, welcome to Diplomates. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Misha. Looking forward to it.
Now, look, you know, unfortunately, it's very difficult to start any conversation these days without the C word. Now, you know, COVID-19, now this is a foreign policy podcast. You're obviously Labor's defence shadow. To your mind, what do you think is the single biggest, you know, so many changes have come from COVID-19, but what do you think is the single biggest foreign policy challenge that's come from the crisis?
It's a really good question. I suppose what I think is ultimately, I think it's an accelerant. If I was to identify anything, I think the sort of trends that we had seen out there probably go faster, but part of the world that we're in was one that was much more difficult to predict and obviously challenging for Australia. I mean, we used lines like, this was the most challenging set of strategic circumstances that we had faced since the Second World War. And we were saying that before COVID-19 took hold. I think this has made that, you know, much more so, kind of multiple times so. And so the breadth of possibilities for us, the unknowns for us, all of those are much bigger. And what it, you know, ultimately where you get to is not being able to answer all the questions about what COVID-19 means. But you do realise these are really challenging strategic circumstances for us as a nation. And so the need for us to be able to take care of ourselves has probably never been as important, or at least as important since the Second World War.
I think that's right. And certainly you can feel the way that seems that the compression of history, and the pulling forward of things.
I mean, it's a really good term.
One of the things you just mentioned is looking after ourselves. Now, I think a lot of Australians were shocked by some of the shortages that we saw in terms of PPE, health and safety equipment. You know, sovereign capability has now become a bit of a new theme, something that I'm very interested in. But, you know, given the exposure to just-in-time supply chains, And given this sort of, you know, this sense now that we don't necessarily produce enough of the things that we need, you know, in a defence context, what are the must-haves for Australia? What are the things that we really need to produce here, to your mind?
Yeah, well, again, so this is a really good example of where it's changed thinking, or perhaps, really clarified thinking. So, I mean, if you'd said to me back this time last year that the making of surgical masks was a thing that was essential to Australian security, I would have laughed. And yet, earlier this year, we had members of the Australian Army at a factory in Shepparton, I think, helping to churn out masks because we didn't have enough of them. And so if something as kind of simple, really, as a surgical mask can be seen or become central to our own security, it then, well, what else? And it raises a whole lot of questions about that. I mean, from a defence point of view, I think the traditional answer to this question is that we, in an environment where the kind of platforms that you operate off are incredibly complex, and you take the Joint Strike Fighter as an example. I mean, this is a fighter plane which has been made in and by numerous countries, and there are absolutely global supply chains in place there. What the notion that, going back to the Second World War, we saw the making of fighter aircraft as part of our sovereign capability, that's kind of not going to be the case now. But where people have got to in their thinking now is we at least need to be able to maintain and sustain the platforms that we use here in Australia. So it's certainly that. I think, though, you know, there does need to be something of a... an audit of all the defence capabilities that we have, inputs that we have, and then say, okay, over and above that traditional setting, we clearly do need to be able to sustain and maintain the equipment that we use. But are there certain things in addition to that or as part of that that are absolutely critical? And I don't have the full answer to that, but I think a much broader assessment of what's in that basket we will come to see as being what defines sovereign capability going forward.
Now, obviously, there's the what of sovereign capability, i.e. the things that you get, and what are the things we need to have here, what are the things we need to store. But in terms of also the where, the Henry Jackson Society did a study which showed that of the Five Eyes nations, that Australia was most exposed of all nations to the Chinese Communist Party in terms of key production areas. They identified 535 areas, including 30 that were critical to future economic innovation. I mean, should we care about the regime that supplies the goods as well as the goods themselves?
That's a good question. I mean, so answered not specifically in relation to China, but in the abstract. I mean, of course, we need to be thinking about the places from which we import material and the places that we, in effect, do business with. I mean, that historically that's been the case, and we do that. We do that right now. So we would say in relation to Iran and North Korea, for example, that there are our ability to do business with those countries is significantly curtailed. In that spectrum, where does China fit? Well, I mean, we're not in a defence context. Obviously, there's not a lot of interaction in terms of defence supply chains, and one can understand that. I think it is important, while China raises a whole lot of challenges in terms of Australia. It is a country with whom we've had a relationship for, going back to the Whitlam government. I don't put China in the same category as countries like Iran or North Korea. I certainly don't put China in the same category as the Soviet Union. I don't think that's who we're talking about. And I think that the economic relationship that we have with China is appropriate. Now, in saying that, we want to make sure as a country that we have a diverse set of trading relationships around the world. That's just prudent. I mean, it's in a sense the equivalent of having a balanced, financial portfolio. We need to have a diverse set of trading relationships, and we are, and particularly as a country, which is reliant on trade. But I do think that we have had an ongoing trading relationship with China. I think that is fair enough, and I'm comfortable with that going forward.
Now, in terms of, you talked about the speeding up of history, so to speak, and a contested Indo-Pacific is something that's going to be an inevitable feature of Australia's foreign policy settings. Now, in terms of defence procurement and new kit, Australia, we've made this sort of commitment, I think it's a bipartisan commitment, to 2% of GDP, which, is around, give or take, around $40 billion a year. I mean, do you think, given the challenges that we're seeing and the speed of which this is going, I mean, is that enough in terms of a broad commitment?
I think it's important that we determine our spending in relation to defence based on the strategic challenges that we face. Like that's kind of, when you think about it, a matter of logic. You know, if a country's strategic circumstances are very predictable and certain, then it can get away without spending a lot. Countries which find themselves in a precarious position spend more. The rational act here is to be spending in proportion to what our strategic circumstances dictate. And as I said to you earlier, what I know is that they've become a whole lot more complicated rather than more simple as a result of COVID. But even prior to COVID, they were as complex as they've been for a long time. So that's got to be the guide in terms of what we're doing. Then the second point is that whilst 2% of GDP is a good benchmark, I do think that ultimately what's important in terms of defence spending is that you have an absolute amount. In other words, that it's not a function of GDP, because you need certainty in relation to programs over a very long period of time, which if spending kind of fluctuates as a function of how GDP fluctuates, is going to make it hard to deliver those programs. So you look at submarines, for example. I mean, this is a program which is going to be delivered over decades. There needs to be a predictable funding stream over that period of time. So, you know, I guess I make that point in a context where we're in a recession for the first time in the better part of 30 years. You know, if you measure defence spending as a proportion of GDP, that has implications there. And you know, I think we need to be mindful of that. And the final point I make is that it's really important that our defence force is dense, by which I mean there is a risk in having a hollowness about your defence force if you don't have the wherewithal to ultimately use the critical platforms that you have. So we are purchasing, and I think appropriately so, some pretty significant platforms in terms of the Naval Shipbuilding Program, but also Land 400, and we mentioned earlier the Joint Strike Fighter. So across the three services, you know, you're seeing a significant and appropriate modernisation of equipment, but it's really important that we have the grunt behind that to make sure that we can use all of those, that we've got enough people, for example, that if we have the better part of 100 fighter planes, we can use 100 fighter planes. If you've got 100 fighter planes but you've only got the personnel to actually effectively operate a smaller part of that, well, then you don't have 100 fighter planes because you can't use them. So that's what I mean in terms of there being we've got to guard against the hollowness in the way in which we have a defence force. And a number of observers, serious observers, have made that observation about where we're at the moment. So we need to make sure that in terms of our spending, we're the opposite of that, which is why I say we need to have an ADF, which is robust and dense, you know, the opposite of being hollow. And I think that's a very important thought in terms of how we set our budget. Ultimately, we face a really challenging world. We face a challenging world where we have an assertive China, which is doing what great powers do. So I don't really even say this with judgment. I mean, China is seeking to shape the world around it, but that does raise challenges for us. And our alliance with the United States is profoundly important, and I think is as important as it has ever been going forward. And from where I sit, the more we have America engaged in East Asia, the better. But it's also true to say that there has been, we have an American president who would regard unpredictability as being a virtue, and I can understand that, but it makes life difficult for allies. And so I think with all, you put those things together, and what that means is we've got to make sure that we're in a position to, you know, be able to look after ourselves. And that's why defence spending at this moment in time really matters.
Yeah, and I want to dig into, you know, the questions about US-China relations and what it means for Australian policy. But before we get off procurement, I mean, you know, given the amount of money we're spending on new kit, and it's, you know, they're big programs we're talking about here. I mean, can we do more? I mean, in terms of innovation policy, what's the role that the Defence Procurement Program can play in sort of driving Australia up, the innovation chain, and how can we make it to, make a more complex Australian economy in terms of its manufacturing innovation capability?
Well, defence industry, I think, plays a really important role there, and has done with a number of countries. I mean, if you go to a place like Israel, they will say that so much of their being a country where innovation is very central to their economic character, that at the heart of that is defence industry and the kind of innovation that you see in defence industry. And partly that's because defence equipment is about as high-tech equipment as you get. It is literally at the very cutting edge of innovation and science. So if you're in the business of making high-end defence capability, then what you are is in the business of making high-end manufactured product. And for a first world nation, that's central to the ability to engage in manufacturing. Successful first world economies that have export manufacturing as part of their economy do so at the highest end of the value chain, and defence industry can play a really important role in getting you there. Having said that, I mean, it's important that we understand how you get defence industry. It's not, when you look at countries that do it, they didn't start off doing it because they thought, well, if we do defence industry, that will lead the rest of the economy. They've done it because they've had a strategic reason to be engaged in it. Israel is a very obvious example, given the threats that have surrounded it for most of its existence. But you can take a country like Sweden, which has a really strong defence industrial base through a company like Saab, and at the heart of that is strategic decisions as well. I mean, Sweden was not a part of NATO, was really right there next to the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War, and so needed to be in a position where it was able to look after itself and needed to have a capacity to do defence manufacturing within its borders. If Sweden had been a part of NATO, I'm not sure, for example, that Saab would exist in quite the way that it exists today. So it's strategic circumstances and strategic decisions that countries make, which end up leading to successful defence industries, and then the benefit that can have for the general economy becomes a spin-off. You know, one of my criticisms about where the government is at is that, you know, thinking through the ecosystem of defence industry hasn't been their strong suit. And so there's never really been a proper strategic rationale which has been put forward by the government for why we would have a defence industry. I mean, there has been, I think most observers would say that this government, having seen the car industry leave our shores on its watch, was looking for some answer to industry policy, and so has leapt upon defence industry as a proxy for a general industry policy. Well, okay, if that's what they've done, is there an example anywhere in the world where that's worked? I don't think there is one. Strong defence industries come about through a strategic decision about having them in the first place. Now, I actually think there is a strategic rationale for us having a defence industry, but you just never hear this government seek to articulate it. I think at the heart of what would be a strategic purpose for us having a defence industry is the fact that defence exports and defence partnerships around industry really go to the core of a nation's interests and trust. So if you think about the situation we're now in with France, with the building of our submarines, that has dramatically changed and upgraded our bilateral relationship. France now is critically important as a bilateral partner to us as a nation because they're involved in the building of our submarines. Well, actually, there's the opportunity for us in terms of the way in which we engage in defence industry to start partnering with a whole lot of countries in our region. And if we did that, I think defence industry could play a really important role in helping Australia be taken more seriously within the region and within the world. And that's really important for us for a whole range of reasons in terms of our shaping our strategic circumstances and putting us in a much better position. And I think defence industry, we can do it and can play a really important role there. But you need to actually make that argument. And it's not just you need to make the argument to the Australian people. I think you need to make that argument to the defence establishment. And I frankly think this government haven't even thought about the argument, let alone made it. And so as a result, you're kind of seeing all the hoopla that surrounded their claims around defence industry when Christopher Pyne was defence industry minister and then defence minister. I mean, that's just all gone by the wayside now. And there is just a barren silence. And there's a real question about whether defence industry is actually being pursued by this government now or not.
So turning to, you know, US-China relations, I mean, at the moment, it just seems that a day doesn't go past without some kind of an escalation between both sides, and certainly in rhetoric in terms of also in diplomatic action. And Australia has likewise found itself in a similar situation. I mean, how should Australia handle this increasingly tense relation between the Chinese Communist Party and the principal trading relationship on one hand, and then, as you said, our absolute critical security alliance, that's our long-standing relationship there? I mean, how do we navigate and triangulate this? Or can we?
Well, look, it's a really good question. I suppose the starting point is, I think the world feels a lot safer and more secure and more predictable when China and America are talking with each other. So it's in our interest that that relationship be as best as it can be. And if it's in our interests for the relationship between America and China to be in the best possible shape, then it actually stands to reason that it's in our interest for our own relationship with China to be in the best possible shape. And so we do need to think about that. And that actually requires, you know, the adults in the room when it comes to this government playing a part in determining Australian foreign policy. And right now, the adults such as they are, I think, are pretty silent. We don't hear a lot from our foreign minister about a pretty fundamental issue in terms of our relationship with China, and we don't hear that much from our prime minister, to be honest, either. And the space tends to get filled by a lot of fringe dwellers on the part of the government ranks, and I don't think that helps. I think the second point is we need to have a kind of underlying philosophy, like what are the guiding principles that we seek to put in place in terms of our relationship with China. The guiding principles in terms of our relationship with the United States are clear. You know, they're our alliance partner. We have shared values, and you know, we often use that phrase that really means we're both democracies. We both respect the rule of law at home, but importantly, we both seek to create a global rules-based order, and we've been parties in seeking to do that really since the aftermath of the Second World War. And we see that global rules-based order where issues and contest is determined by rules rather than power as being central to a stable and prosperous global environment, which really is the way you would characterise the environment in East Asia for most of the period since the Second World War, with the obvious kind of exceptions of, you know, the Korean War and the Vietnam War. But those aside, we have seen a high degree of stability in that period, which has allowed East Asia to be a part of the world, which has been an economic powerhouse, and that's been of enormous advantage to Australia. So, but they are the shared values. And so what we're about in our relationship with the United States is clear. But what is it that we seek to, what is the guiding principle behind our relationship with China? What are we trying to do here? And so I think the first thing is we don't really ever get an answer to that question from this government. I think getting a government minister to try and have a crack at even answering that, you'd be hard pressed. And so often it feels to me like what you get is, you get kind of two irreconcilable propositions or two propositions which they don't seek to reconcile is perhaps the way to put it. Yes, China's a great country to deal with. On the other hand, China creates anxiety, as the government would describe it. Well, you know, I would say that that's not but that's not particularly helpful in terms of having a way forward. For me, and it's just my view, but what I think matters is that there is a view, but my view. I think the starting point is in our relationship with China, actually, that we make clear we're in alliance with the United States, and that is fundamental to our worldview and to our national security. But from the place of being in alliance with the United States, we value the relationship with China and we seek to build the best relationship that we can, one which is robust enough that we're able to express our national interests when that differs from Chinese action, one where we can raise questions of human rights, but we do so in a manner which also acknowledges human rights achievements, and there are human rights achievements in China, which we should acknowledge. I mean, it is important to speak on behalf of the Uyghurs, for example. It's also important, if we're being fair, to acknowledge that China is responsible for the single biggest alleviation out of poverty in human history. It's impossible. It's important to say both sides of that equation. And we also need to submit ourselves to judgment. I mean, part of the global order is that and what we have sought to do since the Second World War with something like the Human Rights Commission is to place stock in the international community's judgment of individual countries, and that means we're not immune from that judgment. So in a sense, we come to this with humility, but we will participate in judgment, and it's important that we do that. And from that place, we do seek to do all of those things, but build the relationship, and trade is a critical part of that. Now, I actually think that can be done, but it does actually require articulating some kind of underlying set of principles, which I've tried to do, and then it requires doing decent diplomacy. I mean, there needs to be some personal relationships between senior figures in the Australian government and senior figures in the Chinese government. I don't actually think there's one. I mean, I literally don't think there is a single relationship that exists between a senior member of this government and a member of the Chinese government. Now, that I find that astonishing. And I find it astonishing in the context of how significant the relationship is, both in terms of its challenges and its opportunities for our nation. It's certainly, you know, under previous governments, there were personal relationships which were able to mediate the difficult moments. But right now, there is just nothing. And I think that's a real issue. So, you know, I think we've got to do our foreign relations as a nation a whole lot better. I think we've got to have a set of guiding principles, and then I think we've got to do our diplomacy well. This isn't rocket science. This is just saying we've got to actually do foreign policy like, you know, a grown-up nation that we should be. And I think that would go a long way to helping us navigate what is a difficult terrain.
So, I mean, it goes without saying that currently we're not in the good books of the Chinese Communist Party, and, you know, you talked a lot about striking the balance there. The business community basically sort of goes into a tears every time the relationship gets into any sort of choppy waters, saying essentially we should just acquiesce for the benefit of just, you know, letting the good times roll on. You know, in terms of the decisions that have sort of earned the ire, you know, if you look at foreign interference laws, if you look at decisions relating to Huawei and 5G, if you look around calling out of misinformation, if you look at South China Sea in terms of the, you know, adherence to international law, perhaps even more recently around Hong Kong, though we tend to not really talk a great deal, to be honest, about domestic affairs in China as a country. I mean, which of these things would you say that we've got it wrong on? I mean, because we've sort of, an issue's approached, we've taken a decision, and it's a sovereign decision of Australia, which has seemed to, you know, earn the ire of the Chinese Communist Party. So it's very difficult to understand how you can navigate it in a way that protects sovereignty without stirring them up in that sense.
Well, I guess the answer to that question is what I've given. You know, I don't think we're doing our diplomacy very well. I mean, I don't think we've got those relationships in place.
So you think you can make those decisions but do them in a way that doesn't, you know, I suppose upset the Chinese in the same way? Or
I think you can build ballast in a relationship so that there's at least a chance that you can move forward in a context where we exercise our own voice. Now, let me be clear. It's really important that we exercise our own voice. That is not something that can be compromised. But it needs to be the voice of the nation. And that's what I said before. We have a significant interest in the South China Sea. Most of our trade goes through the South China Sea. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which if you like, is the rules of the road for that part of the world, for the high seas, which includes that part of the world, is fundamentally important to us as an island trading nation. And so we need to be able to exercise our voice in respect of our national interests when it comes to what's going on in the high seas around the world and in asserting the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, specifically in the South China Sea. We must do that. As I said earlier, I think as a nation which seeks to contribute to a civilized world, it's important that we are exercising our voice in relation to human rights issues such as the Uyghurs, noting that we need to do it in a way where we submit ourselves to the same judgment and where we acknowledge other achievements. But that architecture only works if countries are willing to speak out on behalf of people around the world who it sees as being the subject of difficulty. And that's certainly would understate what was going on for the Uyghur population in China. So we need to be able to do those things, and they're not matters on which you should compromise. Having said that, we've seen government members write articles which use ham-fisted analogies between China and the rise of Nazi Germany. Well, I don't think that's helpful at all. I don't remotely think that that's what China is. And I can understand why China gets upset about it. You have George Christensen out there using astonishing language in the context of COVID-19, which is not helping. And we don't have a foreign minister or a prime minister who is kind of articulating a clear voice on behalf of the nation in respect of what we need to be saying in terms of our own national interests, what we should be saying in respect of China, while these voices are going on, so they occupy the space. In a way, those things are gratuitous and they are, I don't think it is possible to defend those sorts of comments. And we're talking about a relationship which matters deeply, which is the basis upon which a whole lot of people in Australia is employed. And that is a reasonable thing to be thinking about as well. And then, underlying all of that is a complete absence of any personal relationships which can help navigate through difficult waters. There are going to be difficult waters with China. China does raise challenges. No one's suggesting that it doesn't. And it is really important that we're able to exercise our national voice in respect of those challenges. All the more reason then to get our diplomacy right and to be doing it in an excellent way. Now, it is possible that we could have the best diplomacy in place with the best personal relationships that exist, but the need to say these things means that China would still act in the same way. But wouldn't it be nice to try that experiment to actually see, how it would go if we did diplomacy well? And I frankly think that at a governmental level, I should say, I don't think that this government's doing it. And let me also just be a little clear in terms of clarifying this. I think our professional diplomats do an excellent job. I think our professional diplomats in Beijing do an excellent job, and I know a number of them, and they're very highly regarded. But at the end of the day, at a political level, you need critical relationships with countries that are critical to us. And right now, this government has been an abject failure, really, in developing those relationships. And I'm not sure why anyone would think that that's a good thing.
Now, you talked about doing diplomacy well. So turning to the other side of the coin, the President Trump, the US has become somewhat more of a capricious actor under Trump and has more of a go it alone. It's even been actively hostile, to be honest, to alliances or even multilateral institutions. I mean, what's the implications for a middle power like Australia And I mean, and how can we shore up some of these things? You know, for example, would you support Australia joining expanded G7, something like a G10 with Japan, with South Korea and other countries joining? Do you see a way that Australia can play a balancing role against US capriciousness in that sense?
Well, I'd be careful about using the term, that term in respect of the US. I mean, firstly, I still fundamentally believe that the US is a force for enormous good within the world. And I think that our relationship with the United States, which has been there for a long time, is very deep. It is not just with one person, and never has been. It's at a commercial level, at a military level, at a scientific level, at a cultural level. You know, it is very deep, and that depth is really important right now. That relationship has been, and in many ways continues to be, highly predictable. I think the one thing with President Trump, as I said earlier, is that he would see his own unpredictability as a virtue, and I think that that makes life challenging for an ally. I mean, we would obviously prefer to have a more predictable line of sight about what the president's actions are going to be, but that's not who he is, and so that's just where it's at. But I think it is really important that we understand that we not completely judge America by one person. I mean, the president is clearly relevant, highly relevant to the running of America. But America is a big place, and it's a very deep relationship, and it's a relationship which will be in place, let's say, 5 years from now, irrespective of who wins the presidential election this year. But in a world post Donald Trump, whenever that world is, we will still be in a very strong alliance with the United States, and they still maintain all the core values that we hold. And I think that's really important in terms of how we view our relationship with America going forward. I think it's about putting it all in context and understanding that. I think what we need to be doing is making sure that we are able to take care of ourselves to the extent that we can, that we need to have more of an eye on that. And perhaps the other thing is that we need to contribute to the burden of strategic thought within our region. Like, we need not just to be a dependable, solid ally, but a country which has ideas and views about our region, which actually I think America is hungry to receive from us. And I think sometimes we underplay what we can contribute in that sense. It's probably all a long-winded way of saying I think Australian now is a time for Australian leadership, and I think leadership within our region, but leadership within the alliance as well. And I think that's probably the best way of making sure that we keep the alliance in the best possible shape at this moment in time.
So in terms of Australian leadership then, I mean, do you think we should seek a seat at the table at some of these major, diplomatic groupings? I mean, obviously we under Rudd, Labor was very central in creating the G20 for the GFC response, which is still an important institution. But should we be seeking to deepen and expand our influence in things like an expanded G7 or something like that?
Oh, I think the more tables we're at, the better, to be honest. And I think, that would obviously be a fantastic opportunity for Australia were that to eventuate. And the G20 is a really important forum for Australia, and Australia helping to shape, for example, the East Asian Summit is really important. Australia's pivotal role back during the Hawke and Keating governments in the creation of APEC is important. So I think, you know, these are important bodies for us to be a part of, and I think the reasoning goes a bit like this. If you know, we have a real premium on being taken seriously. That might seem like an obvious and trite thing to say, but it really stems from the fact that we Well, along with New Zealand, our two countries have pretty unique sets of strategic circumstances. Yes, we're in an alliance with the United States, but that's a country much bigger than our own, with a capital on the Atlantic seaboard. And how in the Northern Hemisphere and how they see the world is very different to the way we see it as a country of 25 million people in the Southern Hemisphere in the East Asian time zone. We're not part of, to use a Labor Party analogy, in a sense, we're not part of a faction. You know, we're not a European country in the European Union. We're not an African country in the African Union. We have to navigate our way in large part on our own. And that means we actually need to play bigger rather than smaller when it comes to foreign policy, because we have to figure this stuff out for ourselves. Like, there is no one else who is sharing the burden of strategic thought about our circumstances. We can do it with New Zealand, but beyond New Zealand and ourselves, we really need to be figuring this out for ourselves. And that means we need to play big. And play big is not just about a kind of misplaced sense of how the extent to which we can shape the world. It's actually about so that we learn. Being at these tables helps us to learn and to understand the way the world works, and we have a premium on that more than most. And if we're going to be able to navigate our own way through, then actually we've got to be out there, being in these forums, understanding the way the world's going to work so that we can plot our path, because it's not really going to be anybody else giving us that. Now, that is actually very different to being a European nation, which can talk to other European nations, or, as I said, an African nation, which can share notes with those other countries in the African Union. We've really got to work this stuff out for ourselves. So in many ways, I often say that we've got a bigger premium on playing big and on being taken seriously than almost any other country in the world, and I genuinely think that's right. And so being present in these places, making sure that we are there at the G20, I think taking our place on the UN Security Council periodically, you know, these are really important things for us to do, because they help us understand how the world's working, and we really need to understand it.
Yeah, and so we've talked a lot about, I suppose, Indo-Pacific, East Asia, Southeast Asia, but, you know, drawing it right down to our backyard, our real backyard, and I know your son talks a lot about this, but the Pacific, you know, I mean, to put it bluntly, I mean, we've had the step up here from the government, but, I mean, is this somewhere where we've dropped the ball? Because this is actively, you know, China is now actively contesting the region. It's traditionally an area where it's been Australia's domain in terms of its diplomatic relationships. I mean, do you think we have dropped the ball here, and are we doing enough?
I think over the journey, it's been as big a blind spot in terms of our strategic framework, in terms of our national security, as any. Now, I welcome the step up, but the step up needs to be more than rhetoric. It's got to be real, and it's got to be noticed by countries in the Pacific, and it's got to be reflected in a fair dinkum changed attitude from people in Australia. I mean, a point I've made a number of times is there's 10 countries in the world who would probably identify their critical number one bilateral relationship as not being with the United States or not being with China, but with us. But go out there and ask anyone to name the 10 countries. I mean, like, it says something about our kind of psyche. I mean, you would think if you're a practitioner in this space that you would rattle those countries off in an instant, because the countries which see us as being completely central to their world necessarily has to define a space in which we are as important as any. And yet, you know, by and large, we tend not to think about this nearly enough in the way that we should. It's, you know, there is huge opportunity, I think, for us to play better and more impactfully within the Pacific in a way which will change positively the lives of those who live in the Pacific. But we've really got to, you know, commit to that. And we can't do this on the basis of being worried about what others might do in the Pacific, in the sense that if our only reason for engaging with the Pacific is because of what someone else might do, well, then we're getting it wrong from the start. You know, our call to action in the Pacific, I think, should be really clear. The Millennium Development Goals, which were a relative measure of progress around a range of social indicators between the years 2000 and 2015, had the Pacific performing worst of any region on the planet. Now, I actually think that has something to do with us. That is, as you say, the region most proximate to us. It's the part of the world where we can make the most difference. What that says is that at a point in time, if we don't change that trajectory, then the Pacific will end up being the least developed part of the globe. And that's patently unacceptable. That will be reflected in maternal mortality rates, in short life expectancy, in low education, and a range of other social indicators. That ought to be the clarion call. You know, we ought to be listening to that and saying, okay, that's not acceptable in a part of the world where we have an ability to have a big impact. And so let's really unpack the issues around that and try and affect meaningful change in relation to that. And that's the way we will become the natural partner of choice for the countries of the Pacific, by demonstrating to them that central to our interest is not any other country, but them. But it does require us to, you know, I think, have a significant sea change in the way in which we think about this. And ultimately that goes to who we are as a people. You know, like that becomes a statement about how we see the significance of Australia as a polity in the world, positively impacting the world. And so I feel that Australian leadership, which is so central in terms of helping shape our strategic circumstances on the big questions that we've been talking about, the relationship with the United States, the challenges that are posed by China, Australian leadership is critical in terms of as best we can shape those strategic circumstances. But that Australian leadership, in my view, begins in the Pacific. That's where we find it. And so it really does require us to think very deeply about it. I do think that there has been more attention in relation to the Pacific over the last couple of years, but I don't think nearly enough to turn around what I think has been a blind spot for this country for a long time.
I mean, you spoke in a very, very positive context there, but I mean, there is a flip side there where there's some systems competition underway. I mean, how concerned are you about things like debt book diplomacy and, you know, China seeking to basically, rope in the Pacific nations into the BRI program and you know, the prospect there of critical assets falling into control potentially of a more assertive China? I mean, is that something we should be worried about? You know, there was talk about Vanuatu potentially being a base for Chinese military assets. I mean, how worried should we be about that kind of, you know, sort of hard projection of power into our region?
I think it's in Australia's national interest for us to be the natural partner of choice for the countries of the Pacific. I think that's the point here. And I think we get there by focusing on the countries of the Pacific themselves. And I think if we get worried about what other countries are doing, and certainly if we start lecturing the Pacific about who they can have relationships with, then we're not on a pathway to success here. Success lies in us focusing on the relationship that we have with the Pacific and getting that right, and that at its heart is about making sure that we place the interests and the fortunes of the people of the Pacific at the centre of what we seek to be doing in the Pacific. Mm. Now, we can do all that, and we are in a position where we can be the natural partner of choice, and I feel very confident about that. But I also don't think that that's inevitable. I don't think that that happens by us just being here. I think it does in large measure define circumstances at the moment, but I don't think it necessarily always will. But I think it's within our power, if we get our relationship right with the Pacific, to make sure that that is the enduring characterization of our relationship with the Pacific. And frankly, that's in our national interest, but that's in the interest of the people of the Pacific, and it's what we should do. It's who we should be as a people. But I know that if we are really focused on the plight of those in the Pacific, and in a sense the outrageousness of in some places life expectancy for men being in their 50s, and that we really seek with our heart, but with the best brain that we can bring to this equation as well, to change that, then that's all that's going to matter. The rest is actually going to take care of itself. Like, it really will. But that's the place that we've got to get to. And, you know, what frustrates me at times is that, let me sort of declare, I love the Pacific and I've completely fallen in love with it, but it frustrates me that not enough of us understand it and see its importance, but also see the cultural wonder that it represents, and a kind of have opened their hearts to how incredible a part of the world it is, and how lucky we are to really live as part of it and to have the opportunity that we have to contribute to it. And but that's where we've got to go. There's a kind of an emotional connection, which I think that we've got to get to. I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting comparing us with New Zealand in respect of this. New Zealand do, I think, identify in a deeper way with the Pacific for a whole lot of reasons that make sense. I mean, Auckland is a much more Pacific city than any city which exists in Australia. New Zealand is part of Polynesia, so you can see why it happens. And maybe it is a tall order to ask Australia to sort of have that same cultural connection. But actually, we have a lot more presence in the Pacific than New Zealand, much, much more. And if we could back it up with just a bit of that kind of connection, then I think that we, working alongside New Zealand, would go a long way to securing the kind of interest that we need to in terms of the relationships that we should be building with the countries of the Pacific.
Yeah, it's a huge responsibility, and
it is.
Really, it's great to hear you talk about it so passionately. Switching gears slightly, I think the profound challenge, and we could do a whole podcast on this, so, you know, mate, you'll probably have to do this at a reasonably brief level, but, I mean, open and closed systems, you know, open and closed systems, you know, political warfare. I mean, this seems to be, the preeminent challenge of the 21st century, and one of the things that worries me is some of, you know, and I think, you know, obviously share my view of the world in this sense, in that we're both passionate about democracies, passionate about open societies, but autocracies seem to be gaming our openness in a way that is very difficult for us to resist, and at the same time closing themselves off to, I suppose, the virtues of openness that we would say, you know, in terms of interacting with open societies. I mean, how can open societies prevail, and how can they beat closed systems, and do you think they can?
Well, I certainly hope that that human progress and prosperity lies with human rights and with democratic thoughts and democratic freedoms, because that's what I passionately believe in. I think over the long run, innovative thought, both in terms of the evolution of society in a social sense, but also in a technological sense, in terms of science, have performed better in open societies where there is freedom of expression and freedom of debate. And I think that is still going to be the case going forward. I do think that there are real challenges in relation to the evolution of technology, which, you know, present themselves. And I understand the point that you're making, that in closed systems there might be ways in which closed systems can deal with the development of technology around IT. But ultimately, I think this has got a fair way around, and I do passionately believe in you know, the power of you know, government of the people, by the people, for the people. I mean, I think giving putting the people central to the equation is still the best recipe going forward. And so, you know, I don't take democracy for granted. I think it is something that needs to be continually worked at. But I'm as strong a believer in it. I am as strong a believer in it at this point in my life and at this point in time as I have ever been. And I think that it is still fundamentally critical to the future of a more civilized world.
Well, a very uplifting place in the more formal part of the proceedings. Now, I know that you've been dying to get to this part, and the audience can't wait to hear your answers about, you know, the my trademark clunky segue to my incredibly hokey and lame part of the show, the fun part of the show. Now, you're a very worldly man, Richard. Who are the three people, foreign guests, that would come, alive or dead, that would be brought along to a barbecue with you up there in Geelong? You know, it might be difficult to get them there, even if they are alive with the COVID restrictions, mate. But, you know, it's fantasy football, so we can do our best. But who are they and why, mate?
Okay, well, it's so I'm answering this in a political way.
Well, you're a politician, mate. I can't.
You know. I mean, you know, there'd be a sporting version of this. You know, where I would love to meet Tiger Woods, and I'd probably like to meet Bobby Jones. You know, you could kind of throw in the Ablets and Shane Warne.
If Warney's coming, I'm definitely coming. All right, so yeah.
I also think though that it's I mean, they're all I'm sure great people. I love their efforts on the sporting field, and I kind of have a bit of a rule that I don't know whether you want to get to know your sporting heroes. I just enjoy what they do on the sporting field.
You always got to be careful about your heroes. They do say
that. So let me answer the question in a political way, though. Oh, sure. And I would so none of them are alive. Abraham Lincoln, for sure, is definitely my great political hero. But I would love to have him at a barbecue because, by all accounts, he was a raconteur. He was funny. He was self-deprecating. He had a kind of a certain melancholy, but a warmth and a charm about him, which I would love to experience firsthand. And you know, he is the great man. Churchill would be there as well. I mean, Churchill would, whatever else, he would be fun. There would certainly be no shortage of drinks if he was there, and you get the sense that a guy who, you know, routinely was in the bath, as I understand it, with sipping alcohol throughout the entirety of the Second World War. I mean, not that he was in the bath throughout the entirety, but I think he was there on many days. I mean, that is pretty amazing. He is going to be fun at a dinner party. And again, I mean, it is the defining moment of modern history, and he is the central character to it. And you know, if anyone won the Second World War, I mean, obviously, what, not one person, but the person who had the most influence on it was Winston Churchill. And so it would be great to have him there. And the third goes back a bit deeper in history. I think it would be fascinating to speak to Queen Elizabeth I. She really, I think, is probably the great English monarch. And when you think about how does the British Empire come to its preeminence, I think the seeds of it are there in her reign. And she comes to power, you know, her father is Henry VIII. There is a kind of tussle for power, which she was probably unlikely to win and yet does. I doubt there's been anyone in history who's been more underestimated in terms of their ability to do the job. I mean, people were desperate for her to find a partner because they felt that there needed to be a male presence around. And she resolutely refused to do that and then becomes the greatest of them all. That's somebody I reckon would be fascinating to meet. I like her kind of desire to plot her own path and do what she was going to do and not conform to what just about every voice around her wanted to do, that would be a force of nature I'd like to meet.
Right, so three good ones there, mate. Yeah, kicking the ass of slave owners, kicking the ass of the Nazis, and kicking the ass of the Irish and the Scots, mate. So it's a good list. Well, look, leave it there. Richard Miles, thank you so much for your time. It's been a fantastic chat, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Misha.
G'day, Diplomates fans. Thanks so much for tuning in this week. Big thank you to Richard for coming on the show. He's a very busy man, so I really do appreciate him being so generous with his time. If you've got your phone in your hand right now, please jump on, rate and review. It really does help. Let's get ourselves from 6th in Australia to 5th in Australia for the month of August. Thanks for tuning in. See you next time.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show. Or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.